I'm going to start off with a little story I've told before, but it's worth repeating for the purposes of this recording. There was a guy who built an over-unity device, and I learned about it over a decade ago online on the internet. I read about him, and the only purpose, as he saw it, for his over-unity device, he couldn't think of anything else, any purpose to put it to, other than one. He would turn it on, and flawlessly, with such accuracy of timing to the second, he'd time it on his watch, he'd turn it on, and he could count the seconds, and he would always fry itself and destroy itself to the point of turning off, because it wouldn't be able to function anymore as a circuit, always at the same point in time, if he just, you know, by his bare eye, looked at his watch. You know, he didn't use a much more precise timing to see any kind of variation of a fraction of a second. So he was just looking at the seconds on his watch, and he could time it to the second, and it would obliterate itself. You know, the coils would, the insulation on the coils would melt, they'd smoke, and they'd, and so then the coils would short out, and the thing wouldn't work anymore, and so it would stop working. And it was a puddle of rubber and smoke and soot, and it was a mess. And he went to all, and that's all he did, was he'd run it to the point that it would destroy itself, and then he'd have to go build a new one. And he did this ritual over and over again, and that's the only, he got some amusement out of it, because he got proof that he was creating over unity. Well, that made me think, in my latest circuit development, there are certain places where I can get away with putting a 1-ohm resistor there, and it does not hamper the functioning of the circuit, and it probably even helps it. But if I try to put them elsewhere, then the thing shuts off. It won't work properly. And so then I find I have to lower the resistance in those other places to something like 1 milliohm, which is probably comparable to a solder joint. At least it doesn't have to be a welding joint. You know, a welded joint, there is no resistance any different than the materials that you're welding. You know, in this case, let's say it's wire and a bus of some kind, a bus junction point, or just two pieces of wire. So you're not going to have any difference in resistance any greater than the substances that you're welding, because you're just melting them together. But with solder, you're introducing a whole different material that's going to usually be slightly more resistance than the material that you're soldering, you know, the wire, let's say, depending on how much solder you get in there. And I'm such a poor solderer, I usually put too much, and the resistance goes way up. So that's why I tend to sometimes, as an exercise in challenging myself, I'll try to put a resistance in the circuit. And sometimes it turns out that the resistance helps, so much so that it helps to raise it, but not raise it too much. So I've had some circuits where I found out that if I put in one or two, and it wasn't just 1 or 2,000 ohms, it was like 1.1 or 2.2, it was something like that. Yet if I raised it to 4.4, it would shut down and wouldn't work properly anymore. Yet when I had the 1.1 or whatever it was, 2.2, it actually helped it in terms of efficiency. It improved its efficiency to create even more over-unity more quickly in those positions where I put them, but only those and no others. Because what I was doing, and I know what I was doing, what my circuit was doing, it was creating a step-down transformer situation in which some areas were supposed to accumulate voltage while other areas were supposed to accumulate current. And by separating these two functions in a circuit, it helps the over-unity process. It's one of the tricks of the trade, so to speak, that I had to learn that I forget about, you know, and then I have to be reminded, oh yeah, that's one of the tools in my toolbox, and so it's worth sharing. I don't have the circuit in front of me to share with you, but it's somewhere back in my memory. I remember doing one, and it did require resistance, elevated resistance in certain places. And then I had another circuit that was also like that, my reciprocating motor circuit. So you can go take a look at that. That's at is.gd/ reciprocating motor, I think was the phrase that came after the forward slash. Anyway, so this recording is all about resistance serving a useful function. So what could it, the current circuit I'm working on and the few places where I put a 1-ohm resistor, and I don't bother anymore putting in the milliohm resistors elsewhere, even though it helps stabilize the behavior of the growth of energy. You know, it stabilizes the simulator so that it doesn't freak out and go belly up on me so readily. Still, it makes for congestion in the circuit, and the circuit shrinks, and my eyesight is not so good. So I tend to take it out and try to simplify the circuit. And it does run more quickly the simpler it is with less components, but it tends to become more unstable in its growth rate, and it can more readily bottom out. And so then I have to raise the Relatol value to 1e to the plus 999, which is infinity as far as the simulator is concerned. And that has to do with relative tolerance for error. You know, how much can it tolerate error? But if I put in those 1 milliohm resistors in all the other junction points of the circuit that can't handle resistance, then I don't have to raise the Relatol to 1e to the plus 999. So it's funny, you know, you find out these peculiarities, and it doesn't mean that there's something wrong with the circuit. It shows that the simulator, and it doesn't mean that I'm breaking the simulator in order to get over unity. It just means that I'm creating instability, and that's one catchphrase that electrical engineers like to do. They like to create a derogatory spin that they put on free energy by not calling it free energy, by calling it instability, an unstable condition of the circuit. Well, that's their fault for not putting in tiny resistances in opportunistic places. Anyway, so, but if the resistance is greater than 1 milli, if it's in a position where it can afford to be something greater, like, say, 1 ohm, then I'm thinking to myself, and the purpose of this recording to share with you, is to designate those resistances as fuses. It's perfect, because then we have a condition in which we have the same situation as that guy I told you about at the beginning of this recording, in which if it should go too far in its development of overunity, you'll be safeguarded by the presence of those fuses, because they will disallow the buildup of voltage, just like LTSPICE tries to do. And so I learned there's another factor in control panel of the SPICE tab of control panel in LTSPICE called volt toll, VOLTTOL. And that's also has a very low setting. I think it's 1e to the negative 6. Unlike Relatol, usually the default is 1e to the negative 3. But again, in LTSPICE, unlike MicroCap, well, I haven't tried it in MicroCap, but in LTSPICE, you can raise the Relatol to infinity, whereas in MicroCap, you can't do that. You can raise it to the number 1, and that's it. And so you still end up with an unstable simulator that can readily become unstable when dealing with overunity circuit designs. And so now I'm beginning to like LTSPICE more than I like MicroCap. I used to love MicroCap, but I really am getting sick and tired of its instability. Now, in MicroCap, you can have multiple inductors on a transformer, but LTSPICE won't let you do that. So there's still some problems with LTSPICE I don't like. But, you know, it just means I got to restrict myself to two coils joined in mutual inductivity situation, and I can't have more than two, you know, at any one point in time. That's just the way it is. So I, you know, each the shortcomings of each simulator forces me to design certain types of overunity circuits and precludes me from designing other types. Because if I can't experiment with it, there's no way I'm going to be able to find out how to make it work. You know, I don't know this knowledge. I just stumble my way through this knowledge. And only when the simulator lets me stumble through it. If it doesn't let me, then I'll never find out that type of circuit. So it helps sometimes to use other simulators, but I can't go in and change the software code of MicroCap or LTSpice for that matter. I was able to do it for Paul Falstad's simulator, but I can't do it for these others, so I just have to take them as they are and live with it, live with their shortcomings, and marvel at their pluses. So now I can raise Volt Toll to infinity, and so I won't get floating node error messages anymore, you know, due to the fact that I want the voltage to rise, because that's the whole point. Free energy really amounts to free voltage, because current is a circumstantial or kind of a slightly sophisticated circumstance that you design purposely. You know, you do a transformer situation, you transfer the voltage in a step-down fashion, so you're going to lose some voltage, but you got it for free, so who cares? And your secondary that you transfer the voltage to, you short it out with itself. So it's a coil of smaller inductivity, so it's a step-down situation, and then you short it out to itself, and now, depending on the size of the resistor you use to short it out with itself, will determine the ratio balance between voltage and current that you get on the secondary. So if you want a 1.5-to-1 ratio of volts to amps, then you just put a 1.5-ohm resistor when you short out that secondary coil, and you'll get exactly the volts and amps that you want. You know, so what would that be? That would be 200 volts maybe on the primary and 150 volts on the secondary. No, excuse me, 150 amps on the secondary. No, I'm sorry. You'd get 200 volts on the secondary and 150 amps on the secondary. Sorry, I'm not thinking. Anyway, so if we put fuses in the areas of the circuit that can tolerate the resistance of a fuse, now we've got a safety check for that so-called floating node condition that maybe we wanted in the simulator, but we don't want in the real world. We want it in the simulation, maybe. But when it comes time to build it, we're not going to want that. So we're going to want the 1-ohm resistor to break down and cause the circuit to be broken so that it doesn't function anymore as a safety catch, just in case. Now, we're going to want other methods to, in the real world, build of the circuit to ensure that it doesn't destroy itself. And more importantly, ensure that it gives us the power level that we want and no more than that. And it may be operator, you know. That's the simplest way to do it. If the rise in voltage doesn't happen too fast, then the operator control is the first measure of control that a person can think of. And I'm sure that's, you know, when you've got a simpleton arrangement because you don't know what you're doing, like me, that's about the only avenue of approach you can take, you know, to safeguard yourself, to give yourself the power level you want. Because you don't want to... So let's go back a bit. If the voltage rises too quickly, that's no good, because even if you try to control it, and let's say you're in an EV, and you're driving along and you're tapping the accelerator pedal to pulse your power level, to try to average it out over time. The problem is, it's going to rise so quickly that now you're going to get a jerking effect, and it's going to give all your passengers, including yourself, whiplash. And you don't want to give yourself whiplash. So there's a reason behind trying to regulate the rise of voltage in an overunity circuit. You want it to rise at a certain rate, generally. for safety reason, if it's, you know, the power for driving your car. Now, this may be why the story we have for Tesla's first EV conversion, which was not in 1931, but in 1897, why he had a hydraulic transmission for that very reason, because he needed to step down, you know, because his circuit was so powerful that it would have broken the transmission if had it not been a hydraulic transmission system. And of course, he invented two inventions to make a hydraulic transmission system possible and convert his reciprocating motor into rotary motion of his drive shaft. And so this is wherein I applied this knowledge that of studying Tesla's inventions to my reciprocating motor circuit design that I came up with about a couple of years ago in MicroCap, because it would only be good for a reciprocating piston. It would not, it could not, see, that's what you do if you can't figure out how to take an overunity, you know, circuit that's producing reactive power in which the current and the voltage are out of phase by half a cycle. How do you make use of it? Well, if you don't know how to make use of it in a rotary motor situation, you know, all you know is to pass it through a resistive load to boil water to run a steam locomotive. Well, that's a reciprocating motor. It's a reciprocating piston. You have to use a cam drive system to change the reciprocating motion into rotary motion. But if your frequency is too high, as was the case with my circuit design, as was the case with Nikola Tesla's first EV conversion of 1897, then you've got a problem. You can't use a cam drive system such as we have in a locomotive, a steam locomotive, or in an internal combustion engine. We have to use something else. And what we do is we create an ultrasonic, we're in the same situation with an ultrasonic device. You know, these ultrasonic cleaners that you want to clean your dentures or something, or they use ultrasonics to vaporize water to create humidity, to be a humidifier. So they have a diaphragm adjacent to a piston, a reciprocating piston, and that shakes the water at ultrasonic frequencies, and so then it atomizes, comes out as a mist, and now you've got a humidifier running from a reciprocating motor that reciprocates at an ultrasonic frequency. Well, that's not suitable, that frequency, for conversion into rotary motion if your transmission system is a solid system. But if it's liquid, now you got something to work with. Now it takes only two inventions of Tesla to convert a reciprocating piston into rotary motion in a hydraulic transmission system. Just two. The first is a valvular conduit, he called it. We would call it a one-way valve, a solid-state one-way valve. But he called it his valvular conduit. And it's an amazing device of literally converting high-frequency reciprocation into eddy currents. And those eddy currents are become the one-way valve for his valvular conduit. And that forces, it creates a diode. Okay, so now he's got diodes forcing a singular flow, just like current would be for a diode, but now it's for a liquid. And now his second invention kicks in. And the reason for the hydraulics in the first place was his bladeless turbine, which can function at any frequency. And that's why it's so cool. As a bladeless turbine, it can handle a high frequency. And so now he's in a position to step down that high frequency by using his bladeless turbine to a lower frequency of rotation. And that's the other thing, convert reciprocating motion in. So he took his valvular conduit to erase reciprocating motion into one-way flow, but it still has that frequency in the form of pressure. Because that's what you have when you have a diode. All you get out of a diode is one-way flow of current, but you still have the frequency of voltage taking place that you got to deal with somehow or another. Or not, as the case may be, depending on the situation. But in the situation of a car, you got to deal with it. You got to convert out of that because it's going to get in your way. So he uses his bladeless turbine, and now it doesn't matter what frequency your pressure is. You know, your so-called hydraulic pressure version, mechanical version of electrical voltage. Now, it doesn't matter because the turbine has no blades on it. So you don't have to worry. You know, it's the viscosity of the fluid sticking to the metal plates that are stacked close together that's going to cause that turbine to rotate. So you don't need blades on it anymore because they're closely packed very tiny spaces between them. It's a wonderful, simple concept. And so then he could convert, he could do the conversion of his 18,000 cycles per second reciprocating motor into the 30 cycles per second or 15 cycles per second to give him the RPM that he needed, a step down, to rotate the axle of his wheels and not break the axle, the wheel axle. It's beautiful. All because he had a hydraulic system in place and two inventions to do the conversion. So anyway, I got off on a tangent here, but I love talking in a tangential fashion because it's so fascinating science. You know, all the kind of details that we use to solve technical problems. They're there. The solutions are there. We just have to have the faith in ourselves, in our topic, to solve the problem. Eventually, and we will. Because it's just a technical detail. That's all it is. You know, all these complaints that people have, oh, overunity breaks the physics laws of physics, yada, yada. It's just a technicality. That's all it is, dudes and dudettes. It's all it is. You got to have faith in the overunity and free energy to overcome the technicalities, to find the technical detail solutions. And they are there if you bother to look. But you got to have the faith to persist. And I'll leave you with one thought. If Mother Nature, if you habitually scorn something, Mother Nature is not going to give you the solution that you seek because you scorn it. How could she give you the solution? You've got a bad attitude. And she's going to test you. If you have a habit of scorn and you're trying to switch over to a positive attitude, you're not going to get results right away. Why? Because Mother Nature is going to be testing you to see if you really are sincere about the application of positivity to your newfound attitude in your approach to overunity and free energy. She's going to test you. She's going to put tests and challenges and stumbling blocks in your way in the form of people telling you how wrong you are. You know, that's the easiest way to test you. And you're going to stumble and fall and trip all over yourself unless you pick yourself up and decide, willfully invoke a positive attitude to counterpoise the negativity you're getting from other people or you're getting from yourself. Maybe you're tired, you know? You keep working the problem. You're so stupid, you know? You're not smart enough to figure out how to solve the problem of how to get your overunity circuit to work. And you've got to, and you're tired of it, you know? You're tired of failing. That's another type of stumbling block that Mother Nature will give you. So there are all these challenges you'll have to overcome to challenge yourself to maintain a positive attitude. And if you are persistent, you will overcome. You will succeed. But you have to grow, emotionally mature. It's not just a question of being smart enough. You have to be emotionally mature enough because Mother Nature is not going to make it easy for you for another reason. And it's not a bad attitude that we have in society. It's she doesn't want the universe to blow up, spontaneously blow up. And so she makes it difficult. So it's a safety check. So there's a good reason why it's hard, but it doesn't mean it's impossible and it doesn't mean there's some kind of law of physics that we're violating. It's the law of physics that's the problem. It's not our violation of it. And the problem is not that the law exists. The law is there for a good reason, but it exists in a domineering fashion. And it has no business dominating physical reality because that's the falsehood, that it should dominate everything. Instead, it's a circumstantial law predicated on specific circumstances. And when those specific circumstances don't exist in a particular situation, then that domineering law does not apply. It no longer applies. But when the circumstances warrants it, then it applies and then only. That's the contention I have with the conservation of energy. Not that it's fraudulent, but that it's overbearing. It's heavy-handed in our approach to how we apply it. We apply it too often when sometimes it does not apply. Okay? So now that you got it straight where I stand on that. I'm not against it. I'm just against how we apply it. We apply it wrongfully under certain circumstances. But sometimes it does apply. And so it's warranted. But not all the time. All right, have I repeated myself enough? You got it? All right, okay, good.